The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Mark Weber Report. Mr. Weber is a historian, author, current affairs analyst, and director of the Institute for Historical Review. Visit the IHR at ihr.org. And now, Mark Weber.
Hello and welcome. Much of the world's attention in recent days has turned to the widespread rioting, destruction, and looting in London and other British cities. The Associated Press, for example, reported, "A wave of violence and looting raged across London and spread to three other major British cities, as authorities struggled to contain the country's worst unrest since race riots set the capital ablaze in the 1980s. In London, groups of young people rampaged for a third straight night, setting buildings, vehicles, and garbage dumps alight, looting stores, and pelting police officers with bottles and fireworks. Police called in hundreds of reinforcements and volunteer police officers, and made a rare decision to deploy armored vehicles in some of the worst-hit districts, but still struggled to keep pace with the chaos unfolding at flashpoints across London, in the central city of Birmingham, the western city of Bristol, and the northwestern city of Liverpool. The riots appeared to have little unifying cause. Many appeared attracted simply by the opportunity for violence. 'Come join the fun,' shouted one youth in the East London suburb of Hackney, where shops were attacked and cars torched." Another wire service reported, "Rioting and looting spread across London on Monday as hooded youths set buildings and cars ablaze, smashed shop windows, and hurled bottles and stones at police in a third night of violence in Britain's worst unrest in decades. Prime Minister David Cameron cut short his holiday to fly home to tackle the violence, which appeared to be led by youths alienated by years of underemployment, which left them feeling marginalized even before the economic downturn." And another news service reported, "Some 18,000 police officers are being deployed on London's streets in a bid to prevent a fourth night of rioting, with support drafted from 30 forces. Businesses in some areas closed early in a bid to avoid the kind of violence that spread through London on Monday." One person who has commented on the rioting in London and other British cities is a journalist and columnist for the Herald Sun in Australia, a leading Australian newspaper. This journalist named Andrew Bolt wrote in an article entitled "Multiculturalism at Work" this. He wrote, "Britain's riots show what happens when we underestimate the underclass, or when we even more stupidly import one. 3 days of arson, looting, and violence started, not surprisingly, in Tottenham, coyly described as very diverse. That means it has a large population of people of African and Caribbean descent and is poor, crime-riddled, and sullen. This time, the flashpoint was the shooting by police of Mark Duggan, which led family, friends, and locals to protest outside a police station. There they were joined by yobs summoned by SMS and Twitter, the technology of the mob. Duggan actually best symbolized fault lines which have yawned open in Britain. He was black, although barely a single report dared say so. So irresponsibly timid has been the reporting." Andrew Bolt also wrote in this piece, "We're now told that this is not a race riot like all those others Britain has suffered. yet race may indeed be a factor not least for adding to the bonfire and for helping to make the born right there trash feel even more unmoored in their own country. Large-scale immigration, much of it of people who'd struggle to fit in, has given Britain even more of the poor and marginalized, with no ownership of their new home and its institutions. Are you surprised that most gun violence in London comes from its black minority? Yes, the many white rioters prove race alone cannot explain this frenzy. Britain has a white underclass too, and one dangerously loosened from the soft ties of tradition, religion, and class. How it's been made overmighty in this aggressively egalitarian age by being taught to take pride in the feral, to honor hate in its music, to plead the victim to the welfare officer, to not fear the police, and to owe no duty to the families they form, then forget. And see how they can be reduced to yet another contending ethnic class, fighting newly introduced ones for scarce jobs and government patronage. Then comes the multicultural lobby, stupidly trashing their own culture and traditions, not realizing there's little else to inspire the loyalty of the mob. Well, the outbreak of criminal mayhem that Britain has endured in recent days is much more than a British tragedy. It's the logical and predictable consequence of the prevailing ideology of diversity, multiculturalism, and egalitarianism, and of the policies of large-scale non-European immigration based on that ideology, which have been in place for many years, not only in Britain, of course, but also in France and other European countries, and also here, of course, in the United States. This orgy of rioting and destruction is a stern indictment of the capitalist, mass democratic, social-political system that prevails in Britain, most of Europe, and in the U.S. And this violence underscores once again the dangerous falsehood of the slogans of diversity, multiculturalism, and egalitarianism that are key features of the official ideology that is entrenched on both sides of the Atlantic. Now, none of this is or should be considered an indictment of any particular group, race, or religion. If the history of the past 100 years teaches us anything, it is that when peoples of different cultures, backgrounds, and races are put together in the same society, no matter who they are, conflict and tension are entirely predictable. Consider these examples. Until 1905, Norway and Sweden were one country. In 1905, Norway broke away from Sweden. Now, Norwegians and Swedes are pretty similar people. They both speak a Scandinavian language, and they look very similar. But Norwegians did not want to live in the same society as Swedes. It didn't mean that they hated Swedes or thought them inferior or superior. They simply preferred living in a country of people like themselves, in a country where people spoke the same language and had the same culture. Now that's what happened in 1905 when Norway and Sweden separated. One country that was often cited during the 20th century as a model or an example of ethnic cultural harmony was Yugoslavia. The two major groups in Yugoslavia were Serbs and Croats. But in 1991-1992, Yugoslavia broke apart. Serbs and Croats formed their own country, and the other groups of Yugoslavia also formed countries of their own. But it's not because Serbs and Croats thought one or the other is inferior or superior because they hated each other. It's a logical consequence of the fact that people prefer to live with others like themselves. Another example is Czechoslovakia, which very often in the 20th century has been cited as an example of multicultural, multi-ethnic harmony. But in 1993, Czechs and Slovaks, two people, two Slavic people who speak very similar languages and who are very similar in many ways, broke apart, and Czechoslovakia became, on the one hand, the Czech Republic, and on the other, Slovakia. And of course, one of the biggest breakups of a multicultural, multi-ethnic state was the breaking apart of the Soviet Union in 1990-91. The Soviet Union considered itself and held itself up as a model of multicultural, multi-ethnic harmony and brotherhood. But after the rigor and the force of the Soviet Union was loosened, the different nationalities and ethnic groups of the Soviet Union broke apart, preferring to live with people of their own kind. Now, the 20th century has many other examples of ethnic and tribal conflict between peoples who, for one reason or another, have been living in the same place or the same society. Everyone is aware, for example, of the conflict between Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland. Nigeria, the most populous country in Africa, has been plagued by many years of strife between different ethnic groups in that country, including a murderous and devastating civil war. Much of the tension in Iraq is because of the conflict between Kurds and Arabs, or between Shiite and Sunni Muslims in that country. And of course, Lebanon has been plagued by tremendous strife between the different groups in that society, in that country. The rioting and destruction that has plagued Britain in recent days was clearly foreseen 43 years ago by one of the nation's most courageous political figures. In a speech given in April 1968, Enoch Powell, a prominent figure in Britain's Conservative Party, delivered a prophetic speech in Birmingham that set off such a storm of protest that it meant the abrupt end of his political career. In this speech, Powell warned that a policy of permitting large-scale immigration of non-Europeans would have the most terrible long-term consequences for Britain. Britain, he said, was already undergoing, and I'm quoting, already undergoing the total transformation to which there is no parallel in 1,000 years of English history. He also said, "We must be mad, literally mad as a nation, to be permitting the annual inflow of some 50,000 dependents who are, for the most part, the material of the future growth of the immigrant descended population. It is like watching a nation busily engaged in heaping up its own funeral pyre. So insane are we that we actually permit unmarried persons to immigrate for the purpose of founding a family with spouses and fiancés whom they have never seen." He also said, "As I look ahead, I am filled with foreboding. Like the Roman, I seem to see the river Tiber foaming with much blood, that tragic and intractable phenomenon which we watch with horror on the other side of the Atlantic." He was referring here to race riots in the United States, "but which there is interwoven with the history and existence of the states itself, is coming upon us here by our own volition and our own neglect. Indeed, it has all but come. In numerical terms, it will be of American proportions long before the end of the century. Only resolute and urgent action will avert it even now. Whether there will be the public will to demand and obtain that action, I do not know. All I know is that to see and not to speak would be the great betrayal. Well, Enoch Powell's warnings were more than simply prophetic. Today in Britain, one out of four primary school children is of an ethnic minority. That is, one out of four primary school children in Britain is not of British origin or ancestry. Here in the United States, the phrase, "diversity is our strength," has been an often repeated slogan. It's worth stressing that the Anti-Defamation League, a major center of Jewish Zionist power in the United States, claims credit for inventing this slogan. And the controlled American media and prominent U.S. political leaders have widely repeated it. In fact, President Clinton proclaimed, to quote his words, that diversity is our greatest strength. Well, to anyone who has closely studied history or has seen much of the world, the deceit and falsehood of this slogan should be obvious. But perhaps the best proof that this phrase, "diversity is our strength," is a lie is the fact that the very group that invented it does not really believe it. The Anti-Defamation League and organizations like that insist that diversity is a strength, they say, for the United States, or for Britain, or for France, or for other countries. But Israel, they said, should be treated in a very different way. The Anti-Defamation League, which is a staunchly Zionist pro-Israel organization, insists that Israel should not be a diverse state, but should be a distinctly Jewish ethnic religious state. In fact, Israel insists that other people in the United States and in other countries should recognize and acknowledge Israel as a distinctly Jewish state. But the standard is a very different one for every other country. The Anti-Defamation League and groups which support the Anti-Defamation League and other Zionist groups insist that it would be wrong if Norway, for example, was to insist that Norway should be a distinctly Norwegian ethnic state, or that Sweden should be a distinctly Swedish ethnic state, or that Germany should be a distinctly German ethnic state. Instead, they insist that those societies should be open to everyone and should not have a distinct ethnic definition, while insisting at the same time that Israel should be recognized and strengthened as a distinctly Jewish ethnic state. Also in the news during the past week has been the startling decision for many people by Standard & Poor's, the leading rating agency, to downgrade the rating of the credit rating of the United States from AAA to AA+. The downgrading of the United States credit rating will not perhaps have any immediate effects for American people, but it's a humiliation and a warning about the trend that all of us can see all around us in this country and an indictment of the policies of America's leaders in recent years. The downgrading by Standard & Poor's underscores a belief that is more and more widespread that the political leaders of the United States, whether Republican or Democrat, have failed abysmally in carrying out policies that keep America on track, that keep America prosperous. Why is America in its economic downturn today? Why are we having this economic problems that's going on here? Well, the short-term answer is twofold. First, in recent years, the United States, through its policies of free trade, has been exporting jobs overseas, so that increasingly, this is a country that doesn't produce things in the way it used to, and has become increasingly a third world country in the sense that an ever larger portion of its exports have been raw materials, wood, paper, petroleum, minerals, and so forth, and less a percentage of them as manufactured finished goods, and instead the United States has been importing those. The result is an inherently weaker country internally and one in which jobs are increasingly lower skilled and not high skilled. The second big reason, and perhaps more immediate one, is the failure of the U.S. government to supervise and oversee the lending policies of the major financial institutions and banks in recent years. And this led to a rage of irresponsible lending by the major institutions that could not be sustained, and then led to a crisis that required, as the politicians demanded, an enormous bailout by the U.S. Congress and by American taxpayers. And this has led to a tremendous increase in the debt in the United States. Now, to listen to Rush Limbaugh and many Republicans, the impression you get is that all of these economic problems began when Barack Obama became president. But this is a total, of course, distortion of the reality, because the economic downturn began and the crisis began when a Republican was in the White House, and the Republicans were the dominant force in the Congress. But, of course, the most remarkable thing is not how much things have changed, but how much things have continued to stay the same in the United States with Barack Obama as president, both in an economic policy and in foreign policy. And this has, in turn, led to tremendous disgust by the American public, almost despair, that a sense that the leaders of neither political party have any realistic, grounded vision of the future for the country or policies that can really turn things around and return economic health and security to the United States. But increasingly, the American public senses and sees that the problems of the United States are much deeper than merely economic ones, that something is much more fundamentally wrong with the United States. The problems are far more entrenched than just economic, and that they're based on and rooted in policies that have been in place for many, many years now. And that's why, because the problems are so entrenched and so deeply rooted, that neither party is willing to and able to offer any kind of policies to turn things around, because they're committed to short-term solutions or policies that don't deal with these deeply rooted, long-term malaise and problems that have been in place for many, many years. Well, we'll return in the second half of this broadcast to look more closely at some of these entrenched problems and some other items that have been in the news recently as we come back for the second half of this broadcast of the Mark Weber Report.
Stay tuned for more of the Mark Weber Report. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
So living within our means, certainly a foreign concept to so many people. So what will this way of life mean for the future of this country? If we continue to borrow, both as individuals and as a nation, how will we ever climb out of this hole? Nicole Neely is the executive director of the Independent Women's Forum and is here now. Nicole, let's talk about a couple different things. First of all, a lot of big things happened this week, including we saw last week the debt ceiling be raised. Mm-hmm. And so all was supposed to be good after that. We all breathed this collective sigh of relief. And then all these things that they were threatening happened anyway. The stock market went way down to its lowest point since 2008. We got downgraded. Put this all together in terms of how we should kind of make sense of this.
Sure. Well, when S&P downgraded us, Standards & Poor's, which is one of the major rating agencies, they actually weren't the first one to do so. There were three minor ones who had done so before. And one of the minor houses actually has a really good track record of having predicted a lot of the market trends. So that being said, this is something that I think the Tea Party had been cautioning about and that a lot of people were concerned about. Would the debt compromise actually address the underlying issues? Because that was one of the complaints about the Boehner bill, that it actually would not address a lot of the structural problems. As you said, there are still major spending going on, and the compromise really doesn't touch entitlements, which are the biggest driver of cost. That being said, with Standards & Poor's downgrading the U.S., I think it's really just a matter of time until the other two major rating agencies do so as well. So when that happens, I think what we're going to see is, obviously, it's going to cost more to borrow money. The United States is a bigger risk. And when that happens, interest rates are going to go up. And that is going to have a huge effect on the economy.
Although we did hear today from Ben Bernanke, who said that at least for the next year, interest rates would stay as they are.
But that's because he's been holding them artificially low for a really long time. I think, you know, interest rates have to go up anyway, and this is a big problem. Interest rates have been so low and have been held artificially low through various money printing schemes like QE2 because if and when interest rates go up, it will cost more to borrow money. And when that happens, Americans will not spend as much. So this is, I think, very much a trend that needs to happen. We need to save more. We need to not spend as much, and we certainly need to borrow less as a people.
It seems, though, that a lot of individuals in this country, as we just saw in the resident story, as you know, most people I know have a lot of debt. We're following in the footsteps of this government that is living way beyond its means.
Right.
Why do you think it's so common here in this country to have so much debt, to be willing to go $200,000 in debt, for example, for a college education?
I think that there has been, really from World War II on, there's been an emphasis on a consumer culture.
Let's return to the Mark Weber Report, brought to you by VOR.
Hello and welcome back. When we went on break, we were talking about the economic downturn in the United States of recent years and the decision just the other day by Standard & Poor's, the credit rating agency, to lower the credit rating of the United States from AAA to AA+. This was a surprising or even shocking thing to many people because it had never happened before in history, in all the years that Standard & Poor's has been carrying out this kind of rating. It means that for this leading rating agency, which, if anything, has tended to be optimistic and generous in their ratings of bonds and agencies and of countries, the downgrade is a startling thing. It means that for Standard & Poor's, the trustworthiness about paying its bills for the United States is now below the trustworthiness level of Britain, Germany, France, Singapore, Finland, and 14 other countries. The reason given by Standard & Poor's for downgrading is, in short, that Standard & Poor's believes that America's governance and policy making is now less stable, less effective, and less predictable than it has been in the past. And that's what Standard & Poor's said in a statement. But when a country has become less effectively governed, less predictable, and so forth, those are indications of something more deeply rooted, something, a problem more fundamental than that, especially because it's a problem that has never happened before. A recent article points out that in some very serious problems about American society that many Americans would prefer to ignore or forget or overlook. It's an article that talks about how the United States is the world leader in a number of ways that are not very flattering and are very discouraging. The United States has by far the highest incarceration rate in the world. That is, not only more people in prison than any other country, but a higher rate of people in prison than other countries. It has the highest percentage in the world of obese, overweight people. It has the highest divorce rate in the world. Along with Britain, it has the highest number of hours that people watch television in the world. It has the highest rate of illegal drug use. It has more car thefts, reported rapes, reported murders, and total crimes than any other country in the world. A rate of crime, a crime rate for major felonies that is far higher than that of any other industrialized country in the world. It has the largest student loan debt burden of young people of any other country in the world. It has the highest percentage of women taking antidepressants in the world. And it has many, many more military bases around the world than any other country. It's both a symptom of a problem and a cause of a problem that America spends by far more on its military than any other country in the world. In fact, United States military spending is not only the largest in the world, it's larger than the military spending of China, Russia, Britain, Japan, India, and France combined. And, of course, this has contributed tremendously to the national debt burden that everyone is very aware of today because of the squabbling and the dispute between Republican and Democratic leaders over recently raising the national debt ceiling once again. But all of these are signs of a society with problems much more deeply rooted than just the economic ones. And neither political party presents leaders or has leaders that offer anything more substantial than slogans or vague ideas about how America can get out of this. And the problems that we've seen, the rioting in Britain during the last several days, only underscores how little the United States, which has been plagued by race riots and problems like this even more than Britain in the past, is looked upon as a country, as a model country for other societies and other peoples. This past week was also an important anniversary, important historical date. That is, it's the anniversary 66 years ago of the bombing of Hiroshima by the United States, the first time that any country had ever been bombed with a nuclear weapon. A few days later, the United States dropped an atomic bomb on Nagasaki. And those two bombings are the only bombings in history using nuclear weapons against any other country. The bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki is accepted, according to public opinion polls, by most Americans as a military necessity. And that's what the American President Truman said at the time in justifying the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But increasingly, a consensus has developed among historians and among those who have given any kind of thought or analysis to the decision to drop the bomb that it was not necessary. In fact, the pretexts given for the atomic bombing were untrue at the time. The bombing of Hiroshima dramatically ushered in the atomic age with an explosion that completely destroyed more than 4 square miles of the city center of the city of Hiroshima, killing about 90,000 people instantly and injuring another 40,000, many of whom died in agony from radiation sickness in the days and weeks afterwards. 3 days later, when the United States dropped the atomic bomb on Nagasaki, it instantly killed 37,000 people and injured another 43,000. And together, the two atomic bombings eventually killed an estimated 200,000 Japanese civilians. Well, the day after the bombing of Nagasaki, the Japanese government announced its readiness to accept the joint American-British demand for unconditional surrender. And many people assume, of course, that the atomic bomb was the reason for the Japanese decision to surrender. But that covers up or ignores some more important factors, because in the period between the bombing of Hiroshima and the bombing a few days later of Nagasaki, Soviet Union joined the United States in the war against Japan. For a long time, the United States had been prodding the Soviet leader Stalin to break the non-aggression treaty that Soviet Union had with Tokyo, and the Soviet Union did do that. And on the same day that Nagasaki was destroyed, Soviet troops began pouring into Manchuria, overwhelming Japanese forces there. And although the Soviet participation in the war did little or nothing to change the military outcome, Moscow benefited enormously from joining the conflict just days before the end of the war in Asia. Well, the question arises, was the atomic bombing militarily necessary? Well, by any critical, any rational measure, they were not. Japan had already been defeated militarily by June of 1945, several months earlier. Almost nothing was left of the once mighty Japanese Imperial Navy. Japan's Air Force had been all but totally destroyed. Against only the most token opposition, American warplanes ranged at will over the entire country of Japan, and U.S. bombers rained down devastation on her cities, reducing them to rubble. Oil supplies didn't exist anymore in Japan by already since April of 1945, and by July, about a quarter of all the homes in Japan had been destroyed. Her transportation system was near collapse. Food had become so scarce that most Japanese were subsisting on a sub-starvation diet. 6 months before the bombing of Hiroshima, a wave of 300 American bombers struck Tokyo on March 9th and 10th of 1945, killing 100,000 people. It completely burned out 16 square miles and destroyed a quarter of a million structures. This was 6 months before the atomic bombing of Hiroshima. And then, after that, 11 weeks later, on May 23rd, came the greatest air raid of the Pacific War, with 520 giant B-29 Super Fortress bombers unleashing 4,500 tons of incendiary bombs on the heart of the already battered Japanese capital. 2 days later, on May 25th, a second strike of 502 Super Fortress bombers roared low over Tokyo, raining down some 4,000 tons of explosives. Together, these two B-29 raids destroyed 56 square miles of the Japanese capital. Even before the Hiroshima attack, the American Air Force General Curtis LeMay boasted that American bombers were driving the Japanese back into the Stone Age. Now, that's why Japan, months before the end of the war, was already trying to find a way to end the war. Japan's leaders recognized months earlier that defeat was inevitable. Already in April, the emperor appointed a new government with the mission of ending the war. Now, the interesting thing about all of this is that American officials knew full well that Japan was trying to surrender. They knew this because the United States had long broken Japan's secret codes and knew from intercepted messages that the Japanese leaders were seeking to end the war on terms as favorable as possible. Details of these efforts were known from decoded secret communications between the foreign ministry in Tokyo and Japanese diplomats abroad. In fact, a secret memo was already known to American leaders in which the Japanese were offering surrender terms virtually identical to the ones which were ultimately accepted by the Americans at the formal surrender ceremony on September 2nd, including the complete surrender of all Japanese forces and arms at home, on island possessions, and in occupied countries. The Japanese Americans knew were willing to accept the occupation of Japan and its possession, and its possessions by Allied troops under American direction. All of this was known at the time, and the Japanese were reluctant, though, to accept the American demand for unconditional surrender. The Japanese wanted only that the person of the emperor not be violated, that the emperor would not be treated as a war criminal or executed, because for the Japanese, the emperor was a semi-sacred person. Well, as it turned out, the United States accepted this in practice, but it didn't spell this out at the time. And the insistence on unconditional surrender of Japan, which the United States had also insisted upon with Germany, needlessly prolonged the war. For example, on July 17th, an intercepted Japanese message revealed that although Japan's leaders felt that the unconditional surrender formula involved an unacceptable dishonor, they were convinced that the reality made it necessary for them to terminate the war as quickly as possible. Further diplomatic messages indicated the only condition asked by the Japanese was preservation of the form of government with the emperor. The only sticking point was the formality of unconditional surrender. American leaders understood Japan's desperate position, that the Japanese were willing to end the war on virtually any terms as long as the emperor was not molested. If the United States leadership had not insisted on unconditional surrender, that is, if they had made clear a willingness to permit the emperor to remain in place, the Japanese very likely would have surrendered immediately, thus saving many thousands of lives, including, of course, many American lives. Now, the sad irony of all of this is that, as it actually turned out, the American leaders decided anyway to retain the emperor as a symbol of authority and continuity. They realized correctly that Hirohito, the emperor, was useful as a figurehead prop for their own occupation authority in post-war Japan. Well, after the July 1943 firestorm destruction of Hamburg and the February 1945 Holocaust bombing of Dresden and the earlier firebombings of Tokyo and other Japanese cities by conventional weapons, American leaders, in the words of one U.S. Army general, were inured to the mass killing of civilians. The New York Times writer Hanson Baldwin said that the U.S. bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki made us inheritors to the mantle of Genghis Khan and of all those in history who have justified the use of utter ruthlessness in war. Remarkably, even many Americans who are considered conservative acknowledged at the time and later that the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki with atomic weapons was not necessary. In 1963, Eisenhower said, quote, "The Japanese were ready to surrender, and it wasn't necessary to hit them with that awful thing. I hated to see our country to be the first to use such a weapon." Admiral Leahy, who was chief of staff to Presidents Roosevelt and Truman, later commented, quote, "It is my opinion that the use of the barbarous weapon at Hiroshima and Nagasaki was of no material assistance in our war against Japan. The Japanese were already defeated and ready to surrender because of the effective sea blockade and the successful bombing with conventional weapons. My own feeling was that in being the first to use it, we had adopted an ethical standard common to the barbarians of the Dark Ages. I was not taught to make war in that fashion, and wars cannot be won by destroying women and children." The same conclusion was reached by an official U.S. investigation carried out by the United States Strategic Bombing Survey, which rejected the notion that Japan gave up because of the atomic bombings. In an authoritative 1946 report, the survey concluded, quote, "The Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs did not defeat Japan, nor by the testimony of the enemy leaders who ended the war did they persuade Japan to accept unconditional surrender." And this is also the view, remarkably enough, by General Douglas MacArthur, commander of U.S. Army forces in the Pacific. He stated on numerous occasions before his death that the atomic bomb was completely unnecessary from a military point of view. He said, quote, "My staff was unanimous in believing that Japan was on the point of collapse and surrender," unquote. General Curtis LeMay, who had pioneered precision bombing of Germany and Japan and who later headed the U.S. Strategic Air Command and served as Air Force Chief of Staff, put it most succinctly, quote, "The atomic bomb had nothing to do with the end of the war," unquote. Well, also in the news about World War II and the legacy of World War II this past week was a news item involving Russia and Estonia. It was an official protest by Russia over what Moscow called Estonia's glorification of fascists. And that's because the Soviet Union protested about an annual sports and military competition in Estonia called Enerek 2011. The Russian Foreign Ministry condemned the event as an act supposedly glorifying fascists. Now, this annual event is named after an international subversive group that was set up by Germany's Abwehr military intelligence service that operated in the rear of the Soviet Army in 1941 to bring down the Soviet Union. Well, every year, the competition that's held in Estonia, it's been held every year since 1993, is supported by Estonia's defense ministry and general staff, in large measure because Estonia views the World War II conflict very differently than does the Soviet Union or the United States. Every year in the competition that takes place, participants have to demonstrate weapon skills, knowledge of explosives, and ability to survive in extreme conditions. And in this year's competition, teams participate not only from Estonia, but also from Denmark, Lithuania, Belgium, Finland, Switzerland, and Georgia. As already mentioned, the Soviet Union is also unhappy with the fact that Estonia honors veterans who were volunteers in the 20th Estonian Division of the Waffen-SS. Now, the point of all of this is that World War II is very different depending on one's point of view. And for Estonians, the German forces in World War II were not oppressors or invaders, but liberators from Soviet tyranny and oppression. And the Soviet Union is not looked upon as the worthy ally of the United States, which was the position of the U.S. during the World War II, but rather as a tyranny, as a tyrannical oppressor. And that's why in many parts of Eastern Europe and in many countries, World War II is looked at very differently, and people reject the official view of American leaders and Soviet leaders. Not surprisingly, Jewish organizations are also protesting the way that the Estonian government looks at World War II, as shown by these annual events that take place in that country. Well, I hope you'll join me for the next broadcast of the Mart Weber Report. In the meantime, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and questions, and I hope you'll be joining me next time.
Thanks for listening. The Mark Weber Show returns Wednesday, 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. Time, only on VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.